Speak and may you listen in the name of God, Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer. Amen. It is only going to get worse. How much more can we take? You only have to look at the headlines on the Sunday newspapers. In a little over 6 weeks' time, there will be the EU summit, the deadline for an agreement setting out the terms of the so-called withdrawal settlement, the divorce bill between the UK and the European Union. Undoubtedly, journalists and political pundits will have a field day guessing and second-guessing, scrutinising and analysing every step of the parting of the ways. Justin Welby has spoken of the EU as the greatest dream to have been achieved in 1,500 years of history, and of Brexit dividing the country, and the need for a new narrative, one that is rooted in all that is best in our history: solidarity, courage, aspiration, resilience, and care for each other. A narrative that should counteract fear of the other. Brexiteers accuse Remainers of fear-mongering, while Remainers respond with accusations of Brexiteer xenophobia. Each accuses the other of hypocrisy. Perhaps with David Runciman we should ask ourselves what kind of hypocrite we should vote for at the next election. That question may seem cynical, but Runciman claims that it is much more cynical to pretend that politics can ever be completely sincere, that we should accept hypocrisy as a fact of politics. For the most dangerous form of political hypocrisy is to claim to have a politics without hypocrisy. What we need to do is to distinguish between harmless and harmful hypocrisies, worrying about only its more damaging incarnations. This resonates with what the theologian and vicar of St. Martin in the Fields, Sam Wells, has written, and which has relevance for that passage from Mark's Gospel, which we heard a moment ago. Jesus accuses the Pharisees and scribes of hypocrisy, quoting the prophet Isaiah, "This people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines." This is not the only occasion the Pharisees are censured for their hypocrisy, and down the centuries, the assumption has gained ground that a majority of the Pharisees were hypocrites, or as John the Baptist put it, a brood of vipers. So much so that the word Pharisee has become synonymous with hypocrite. Yet this is a misreading of the New Testament, not only mistaken, but offensive. The Pharisees, the Sadducees and the Zealots, among others, were the politicians of their day, dealing with a foreign empire which was running every aspect of government, making laws, raising taxes, arresting, sentencing, and punishing people, sending in the troops when things looked lively. This was the situation that confronted the Jewish people in the first century at the time of Jesus. Today, it may not be a foreign empire which runs every aspect of UK government, but the EU, or so some would assert. For the Jewish leaders, there were broadly two options when it came to the Roman authorities, the ideological and the pragmatic. If you wanted to gain or maintain a position of any degree of wealth and power, you needed to be the pragmatist and collaborate. Without enough troops to run its empire, Rome administered its provinces by way of local leadership, people like Herod, who had authority in Israel as long as he remained loyal to Rome, and Caiaphas, the high priest, appointed by the Roman governor to keep the heart of the Jewish people beating as one with Rome. This was the pragmatism promoted by the Sadducee party, and an acknowledgement that the sovereignty of Israel was dead and buried. Then there were the ideologues who sought to answer the question, how do we get into this mess? In the main, there were three answers. The first was to purify the land of Israel by overthrowing the Roman rule. This was the zealot option, which in practical terms offered little more than an alternative government. For Jesus, the zealots were simply offering more of the same. The second was to accept what the Sadducees had concluded, that there was little or no possibility of changing the existing order, but, unlike the Sadducees, to seek to restore the people's intimacy with God by withdrawing into a rigorous community embracing poverty and asceticism. That was the approach of the Essenes, with their belief that purity and therefore holiness was impossible if they were mixing with, indeed contaminated by, the general population. Third, there was the more democratic approach to this problem of purity. With their holy land and holy places, holy times and holy people, holy bodily mutilation, circumcision, and holy food, it was practically and economically unfeasible for the ordinary Jew to conform to purity codes. For the Sadducees, this meant that only priests could be reliably holy. The Pharisees, on the other hand, were far more inclusive, and reinterpreting the purity codes made them more accessible. The Pharisees were intent on restoring Israel to a right relationship with God by bringing the whole people of Israel, the common people, within reach of the purity codes and therefore holiness. Instead of social withdrawal, advocated by the Essenes, violent insurgency, demanded by the Zealots, or the political expediency of the Sadducees, the Pharisees wanted all Jews to be identifiably God's holy people. In which case, why did Jesus take such a harsh view of the Pharisees? Jesus doesn't directly criticize the underlying inclusive philosophy of the Pharisees, just the way they go about it. He perceived that many were motivated less by an all-embracing holiness and more by bolstering their own social status. That was their hypocrisy. But what about ours? Could we be contemporary Pharisees blind to our own hypocrisy? This is a question which Sam Wells addresses. He identifies hypocrisy as behavior in which we intend to do the right thing, and indeed perhaps think we are doing the right thing, but actually end up doing the wrong thing. We say one thing and do another. Sam believes this kind of hypocrisy is the least bad sin, because at least we're trying. We may be up to our necks in self-deception, but by describing what we believe to be right living, we make ourselves accountable to other people. Sometimes I will end up doing the right thing, if only because I don't want to be humiliated in front of you. The alternative kind of hypocrisy which Sam identifies is more worrying. When we know we're doing the wrong thing while still mouthing the language of right thinking and right behavior. He argues that this is nothing less than cynicism. In other words, the hypocrite is at least trying, while the cynic is morally indifferent. So, perhaps to adapt the words of Runciman, the most dangerous form of religious hypocrisy is to claim to have religion without hypocrisy. I'm not excusing myself, for I am as much a hypocrite as I suspect many of you are. Like Paul, I willingly acknowledge that I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I do. However, I remain accountable to you and to God, and ask you, no, demand of you, that you be my critical, yes, critical companion as I journey the faith. As for those negotiating Brexit, it's not for me to judge their motives. But I return to comments by Justin Welby and his observation that Brexit demonstrates cracks in our society, a society in which there is hate crime, the growth of intolerance, and an inward turn. He asks, how do we witness in Europe today? How do we witness to economic justice? How do we witness to the hospitality of God? A question for you and for me as we face the difficult weeks ahead. How do we witness in Europe today? How do we witness to economic justice? How do we witness to the hospitality of God? Amen.